It's versus totalitarian government, which means capitalism versus socialism. The smear of capitalism's advocates as fascists has failed in this country, and for over a decade has been moldering in dark corners, seldom venturing to be heard openly in public, coming only as an occasional miasma from under the ground, from the sewers of actual leftism. And this is the kind of notion that the liberals are unfastidious enough to attempt to revive. But it is obvious what vested interest that notion can serve. If it were true that dictatorship is inevitable, and that fascism and communism are the two extremes at the opposite ends of our course, then what is the safest place to choose? Why, the middle of the road. The safely undefined, indeterminate, mixed economy, moderate middle, with a moderate amount of government favors and special privileges to the rich, and a moderate amount of government handouts to the poor, with a moderate respect for rights and a moderate degree of brute force, with a moderate amount of freedom and a moderate amount of slavery, with a moderate degree of justice and a moderate degree of injustice, with a moderate amount of security and a moderate amount of terror, and with a moderate degree of tolerance for all, except those extremists who uphold principles, consistency, objectivity, morality, and who refuse to compromise. The notion of compromise as the supreme virtue superseding all else is the moral imperative, the moral precondition of a mixed economy. A mixed economy is an explosive, untenable mixture of two opposite elements which cannot remain stable, but must ultimately go one way or the other. It is a mixture of freedom and controls, which means not of fascism and communism, but of capitalism and statism, including all its variants. Those who wish to support the unsupportable, disintegrating status quo are screaming in panic that it can be prolonged by eliminating the two extremes of its basic components. But the two extremes are capitalism or total dictatorship. Dictatorship feeds on the ideological chaos of bewildered, demoralized, cynically flexible, unresisting men. But capitalism requires an uncompromising stand. Destruction can be done blindly, at random, but construction requires strict adherence to specific principles. The welfare statists hope to eliminate capitalism by smear and silence, and to avoid dictatorship by voluntary compliance, by a policy of bargaining and compromise with the government's growing power. This brings us to the deeper implications of the term extremism. It is obvious that an uncompromising stand on anything is the actual characteristic which that anti-concept is designed to damn. It is also obvious that compromise is incompatible with morality. In the field of morality, compromise is surrender to evil. There can be no compromise on basic principles. There can be no compromise on moral issues. There can be no compromise on matters of knowledge, of truth, of rational conviction. If an uncompromising stand is to be smeared as extremism, then that smear is directed at any devotion to values, any loyalty to principles, any profound conviction, any consistency, any steadfastness, any passion, any dedication to an unbreached, inviolate truth, any man of integrity. And it is against all these that that anti-concept has been and is being used. Here we can see the deeper roots, the source that has made the spread of anti-concepts possible, the mentally paralyzed, anxiety-ridden neurotics produced by the disintegration of modern philosophy, with its cult of uncertainty, its epistemological irrationalism and ethical subjectivism, come out of our colleges broken by chronic dread, seeking escape from the absolutism of reality with which they feel themselves impotent to deal. Fear drives them to unite with slick political manipulators and pragmatist ward healers to make the world safe for mediocrity by raising to the status of a moral ideal that archetypal citizen of a mixed economy, the docile, pliable, moderate milquetoast who never gets excited, never makes trouble, never cares too much, adjusts to anything and upholds nothing. The best proof of an intellectual movement's collapse is the day when it has nothing to offer as an ultimate ideal but a plea for moderation. Such is the final proof of collectivism's bankruptcy. The vision, the courage, the dedication, the moral fire are now on the barely awakening side of the crusaders for capitalism. It will take more than an anti-concept to stop them. Chapter 18, The Obliteration of Capitalism by Ayn Rand. In my article, Extremism or the Art of Smearing, I discussed the subject of anti-concepts, i.e. artificial, unnecessary, undefined, and rationally unusable terms intended to replace or obliterate certain legitimate concepts in people's minds. I said that the liberals are coining and spreading anti-concepts in order to smuggle this country into statism by an imperceptible process, and that the primary target marked for obliteration is the concept of capitalism, which, if lost, would carry away with it the knowledge that a free society can and did exist. But there is something much less attractive, and politically much more disastrous, than capitalism's enemies, its alleged defenders, some of whom are muscling in on the game of manufacturing anti-concepts of their own. Have you ever felt a peculiar kind of embarrassment when witnessing a grossly inappropriate human performance, such as the antics of an unfunny comedian? It is a depersonalized, almost metaphysical embarrassment at having to witness so undignified a behavior on the part of a member of the human species. That is what I feel at having to hear the following statement of Governor Romney, which was his alleged answer to the communists' boast that they would bury capitalism. But what they do not understand, and what we have failed to tell the world, is that Americans buried capitalism long ago and moved on to consumerism. The implications of such a statement are too sickeningly obvious. The best comment on it came from the Richardson Digest, Richardson, Texas, April 28, 1965, from the column Lively Comments by Earl Lively, who wrote, "Afraid to stand alone, even on his knees, Romney then tells the rest of us that we do not know the definition of capitalism. We do not understand our economic principles, and we'd be better off if we quit going around defending such an unpopular concept as capitalism." Mr. Lively is admirably precise in his description of the posture involved, but Mr. Romney is not alone in it. A number of intellectually more reputable men, including some distinguished free enterprise economists, have adopted the same stance and the same line for the same psychological reasons. There are the economists who proclaim that the essence and the moral justification of capitalism is service to others, to the consumers, that the consumers' wishes are the absolute edicts ruling the free market, etc. This is an example of what a definition by non-essentials accomplishes, and of why a half-truth is worse than a lie. What all such theorists fail to mention is the fact that capitalism grants economic recognition to only one kind of consumer, the producer, that only traders, i.e. producers who have something to offer, are recognized on a free market, not consumers as such, that in a capitalist economy, as in reason, in justice, and in reality, production is the precondition of consumption. There are the businessmen who spend fortunes on ideological ads, allegedly in defense of capitalism, which assure the public that all but a tiny fraction of an industry's income goes to labor, wages, the government, taxes, etc., with these shares represented as big chunks in full-color process, and lost among them an apologetic little sliver is marked 2.5% and labeled profits. There is the display of charts and models in a hallway of the New York Stock Exchange presenting the achievements of free enterprise and captioned "The People's Capitalism." Since none of these attempts can succeed in disguising the nature of capitalism, nor in degrading it to the level of an altruistic stockyard, their sole result is to convince the public that capitalism hides some evil secret which imbues its alleged defenders with such an aura of abject guilt and hypocrisy. But in fact, the secret they are struggling to hide is capitalism's essence and greatest virtue, that it is a system based on the recognition of individual rights, on man's right to exist and to work for his own sake, not on the altruistic view of man as a sacrificial animal. Thus it is capitalism's virtue that the public is urged by such defenders to regard as evil, and it is altruism that all their efforts help to reinforce and reaffirm as a standard of the good. What they dare not allow into their minds is the fact that capitalism and altruism are incompatible, so they wonder why the more they propagandize, the more unpopular capitalism becomes. They blame it on people's stupidity because people refuse to believe that a successful industrialist is an exponent of altruistic self-sacrifice, and on people's greed for the unearned, because after being battered with assurances that the industrialist's wealth is morally theirs, people do come to believe it. No anti-concept launched by the liberals goes so far, so crudely, as the tag consumerism. It implies loudly and clearly that the status of consumer is separate from and superior to the status of producer. It suggests a social system dedicated to the service of a new aristocracy which is distinguished by the ability to consume and vested with a special claim on the caste of serfs marked by the ability to produce. If taken seriously, such a tag would lead to the ultimate absurdity of the communists proclaiming, "Who does not toil shall not eat," and the alleged representatives of capitalism replying, "Oh yes, he shall." And if the ad hoc committee on the Triple Revolution propounds such a moral obscenity as the right to consume, who inspired it, Karl Marx or Governor Romney? It is true that we are not a capitalist system any longer. We are a mixed economy, i.e. a mixture of capitalism and statism, of freedom and controls. A mixed economy is a country in the process of disintegration, a civil war of pressure groups looting and devouring one another. In this sense, consumerism might be the appropriate name for it. Now, to whom is it that the friends, the semi-friends, and even the acquaintances of capitalism are so anxiously apologizing? As the clearest illustration of the psychological motives, the moral meaning, and the intellectual technique involved in the manufacture of anti-concepts, I offer you a column by C.L. Sulzberger, entitled "Should the Old Labels Be Changed?" in the July 1964 issue of the New York Times. A research report of the United States Information Agency, writes Mr. Sulzberger, has ruefully discovered that the more our propaganda advertises the virtues of capitalism and attacks socialism, the less the world likes us. Confused semantics make bad public relations. Having analyzed conclusions of its poll takers in both hemispheres, the USIA study observes, "Capitalism is evil. The United States is the leading capitalist country. Therefore, the United States is evil." It would be difficult to exaggerate the harm that this line of thinking has done. In the Soviet Union and Communist China, it sustains attitudes and actions that greatly increase the danger of thermonuclear war. What is meant here by such a foggy expression as "sustains attitudes and actions"? The smear of capitalism as evil was originated and constantly reiterated by the communists. Does the above mean that their own smear sustains their attitudes? And does it mean that the way to avoid thermonuclear war is for us to agree that the smear is true? The report does not say. It merely goes on. In the non-communist world, it tends to poison the atmosphere in which we are trying to carry on our aid programs and other international cooperation. This means that the harm to us lies in the danger that the recipients of our charity might refuse to take our money, and that in order to gain their cooperation, we must spit in our own face and join in smearing the system which produced the wealth which is saving their lives. Capitalism is a dirty word to millions of non-Marxists who see socialism as vaguely benevolent. When the USIA sampled foreign opinion, it found that, to the majority, socialism did not mean government ownership and was not necessarily related to communism. Rather, it seemed to imply a system favoring welfare of common people. If you have doubted that the philosophy of pragmatism actually teaches that truth is to be established by public polls, here is a sample of it, in pure and naked form. Volumes of theory, a century of history, and the bloody practice of five continents to the contrary, notwithstanding, Socialism does not mean government ownership and is not related to communism because a sampling of majority opinion said so. And what is meant by a system favoring welfare of common people? How does one favor the common people at the expense of the uncommon? A favor means the unearned, since the earned is a right, not a favor, whose rights and earnings are to be abrogated and expropriated for whose benefit? The only variant of socialism that can distribute favors without government ownership is fascism. Draw your own conclusions about the political inclinations of the moral cannibals involved in that poll. Most foreigners apparently don't regard capitalism as descriptive of an efficient economy or a safeguard of individual rights. To them, it means little concern for the poor, unfair distribution of wealth, and undue influence of the rich. How does one combine the safeguard of individual rights with a government-enforced concern for the poor and a government-distributed wealth and influence? No answer. USIA found an impressive percentage of British, West Germans, Italians, Japanese, Mexicans, and Brazilians have a favorable opinion of socialism and a strongly unfavorable opinion of capitalism. Consider the philosophical trends, the intellectual commitments, the moral records of these countries, and their political results. Germany, Italy, and Japan were fascist dictatorships. Their claims to political wisdom consist of giving the world a demonstration of horror equaled only by their ideological brothers in Soviet Russia and Red China. Britain, Mexico, and Brazil are mixed economies, which have long since gone over the borderline state of mixture into the category, and the economic bankruptcy, of socialistic countries. And these are the nations whose opinions we are asked to value, whose favor we are asked to court. These are the moral authorities to whom we must apologize for the noblest political system in history, ours. These are the judges whom we must placate by denying our system, dishonoring its record, and obliterating its name. Is there any conceivable motive that could prompt a nation to so base a betrayal? Conceivable? No, if one refers to the realm of rational concepts, but capitalism abroad is frequently a pejorative word. Efforts to purge it of negative connotations by phrases like people's capitalism have failed, but socialism is chic. Yes, chic. Even in Britain and West Germany, where private ownership is the mode, the majority expressed itself sympathetic to socialism, while abhorring communism. If the term social metaphysics occurs to you at this point, you would be right, except that even that term seems too clean, almost too innocent to explain the following. Leaders of underdeveloped nations, spurning capitalism, boast of special brands of socialism. Leopold Senghor of Senegal says, "Socialism is a sense of community which is a return to Africanism." Julius Nyerere of Tanganyika insists, "No underdeveloped country can afford to be anything but socialist." Tunisia's Habib Bourguiba claims, "Mohammed's companions were socialists before the invention of the word." And Cambodia's Prince Norodom Sihanouk contends, "Our socialism is first and foremost an application of Buddhism." The above is true, totally true, true all the way down to the deepest philosophical, psychological, political, and moral fundamentals. And this is the most damning indictment of socialism that a rational person could need to see. Socialism is a regression to primitive barbarism. But that is not the appraisal or the conclusion of the USIA report. It is to the Mohammedans, the Buddhists, and the cannibals, the literal cannibals this time, to the underdeveloped, the undeveloped, and the not-to-be-developed cultures, that the capitalist United States of America is asked to apologize for her skyscrapers, her automobiles, her plumbing, and her smiling, confident, untortured, unskinned alive, uneaten young men. The column ends as follows. The study concludes that foreigners attribute to the USA a high degree of capitalist exploitation and of capitalist power over the society as a whole, as well as a great absence of those social welfare measures which to them are the decisive criterion of socialism. There is surely no sense in proclaiming our philosophy in terms that are unsalable and peculiarly vulnerable to our opponents' attacks. Our system of capitalism has evolved immensely from the outmoded economic doctrine to which the label was originally applied by Marx and other 19th-century thinkers. Might not the USIA attempt another survey, seeking ways of announcing our social and political system in a manner more acceptable to those abroad whose opinions we would influence? Influence how? In what direction? To what purpose? If for the sake of appeasement we renounce our philosophy and adopt theirs, if we discard the last remnants of capitalism and proclaim ourselves to be a nationalist socialist welfare state, who would have influenced and buried whom? A great many things may be observed about this unusually revealing column. It is true, of course, that if American propagandists are defending capitalism abroad as they do at home, the results would be precisely as described in that USIA study, or worse. At home, it is the conservatives who are appeasing the liberals and losing the battle, because they dare not uphold the true nature of capitalism. Abroad, it is the liberals who are appeasing the communists and losing the battle for the same reason. There is no way to defend capitalism without upholding man's right to exist, which means without rejecting altruism. Observe the appalling indifference to the issue of truth or falsehood on the part of capitalism's alleged defenders. They attach no significance to such contradictions as sympathizing with socialism while abhorring communism, or to the fact that capitalism is the only opposite of and the only defense against communism. They attach no significance to the ignorance, the dishonesty, the injustice, the irrationality of capitalism's critics. In the face of a moral philosophical issue, their response is an immediate, uncritical acceptance of the critics' terms, a surrender to ignorance, dishonesty, injustice, irrationality. In the face of the knowledge that capitalism is being smeared by the communists, by the very enemy they intend to fight, their policy is not to blast the smear, not to enlighten the world, not to defend the victim, not to speak out for justice, but to sanction the smear, to hide the truth, to sacrifice the victim, to join the lynching. What they feel is, of what account is truth in the face of such a consideration as people don't like us? What they cry is, but this is the way we'll make people like the victim, after we've helped them grind her to bits in the mud. Then they wonder why contempt is all they earn from betrayed allies and sworn enemies alike. Moral cowardice is not an attractive, nor an inspiring, nor a very practical trait. Observe the obscenity of those Europeans who, in this day and age, in the rising tide of global bloodshed, in the face of the unspeakable atrocities of the newly emerging nations, dare prattle about little concern for the poor and criticize the United States for that. Whatever their motives, concern for human suffering is not one of them. We may observe all that, but it seems almost irrelevant beside the one central overwhelming fact. The intellectual leaders of today's world are willing to condone and accept anything. They are willing to recognize the right of Buddhism and Africanism to their boastfully asserted traditions. Remember the nature and record of those traditions. But they make one exception. There is one country, the United States of America, who is not acceptable to them, who must renounce her tradition and, in atonement, must crawl on her knees begging the savages of five continents to choose a new name for her system which would obliterate the guilt of her past. What is her guilt? That for one brief moment in human history she offered the world the vision of unsacrificed man in a non-sacrificial way of life? When one grasps this, one knows that it is no use arguing over political trivia, or wondering about the nature of altruism and why the reign of the altruists is leading the world to an ever-widening spread of horror. This is the nature of altruism. This, not any sort of benevolence, goodwill, or concern for human misfortune. Hatred of man, not the desire to help him. Hatred of life, not the desire to further it. Hatred of the successful state of life, and that ultimate apocalyptic evil, hatred of the good for being the good. what every successful man, successful at any human value, spiritual or material, has encountered, has sensed, has been bewildered by, but has seldom identified, can now be seen in the open, with nations, instead of individual men, reenacting the same unspeakable evil on a world scale where it cannot be hidden any longer. It is not for her flaws that the United States of America is hated, but for her virtues. Not for her weaknesses, but for her achievements. Not for her failures, but for her success, her magnificent, shining, life-giving success. It is not your wealth that they're after. Theirs is a conspiracy against the mind, which means against life and man. It is a conspiracy without leader or direction, and the random little thugs of the moment who cash in on the agony of one land or another are chance scum riding the torrent from the broken dam of the sewer of centuries, from the reservoir of hatred for reason, for logic, for ability, for achievement, for joy, stored by every whining anti-human who ever preached the superiority of the heart over the mind. Atlas shrugged. With most of the world in ruins, with the voice of philosophy silent and the last remnants of civilization vanishing undefended, in an unholy alliance of savagery and decadence, bloody thugs are fighting over the spoils, while the cynical pragmatists left in charge and way out of their depth are trying to drown the panic at Europe's cocktail parties, where emasculated men and hysterical white-lipped women determine the fate of the world by declaring that socialism is chic. This is the face of our age. To attempt to fight it by means of compromise, conciliation, equivocation, and circumlocution is worse than grotesque. This is not a battle to be fought by joining the enemy in any manner, nor by borrowing any of his slogans or his bloody ideological equipment, nor by deluding the world about the nature of the battle, nor by pretending that one is in with that sort of crowd. It is a battle only for those who know why it is necessary to be out, as far out of that stream as words will carry, why, when moral issues are at stake, one must begin by blasting the enemy's base and cutting off any link to it, any bridge, any toehold, and if one is to be misunderstood, let it be on the side of intransigence, not on the side of any resemblance to any part of so monstrous an evil. It is a battle only for those who, paraphrasing a character in Atlas Shrugged, are prepared to say, "Capitalism is the only system in history where wealth was not acquired by looting but by production, not by force but by trade, the only system that stood for man's right to his own mind, to his work, to his life, to his happiness, to himself. If this is evil by the present standards of the world, if this is the reason for damning us, then we the champions of men, accept it and choose to be damned by that world. We choose to wear the name Capitalism printed on our foreheads proudly as our badge of nobility. This is what the battle demands. Nothing less will do." Chapter 19. Conservatism, an Obituary, by Ayn Rand. Both the conservatives and the liberals stress a fact with which everybody seems to agree, that the world is facing a deadly conflict and that we must fight to save civilization. But what is the nature of that conflict? Both groups answer, it is a conflict between communism and what? Blank out. It is a conflict between two ways of life, they answer, the communist way and what? Blank out. It is a conflict between two ideologies, they answer. What is our ideology? Blank out. The truth, which both groups refuse to face and to admit, is that politically the world conflict of today is the last stage of the struggle between capitalism and statism. We stand for freedom, say both groups, and proceed to declare what kind of controls, regulations, coercions, taxes, and sacrifices they would impose, what arbitrary powers they would demand, what social gains they would hand out to various groups, without specifying from what other groups these gains would be expropriated. Neither of them cares to admit that government control of a country's economy, any kind or degree of such control by any group, for any purpose whatsoever rests on the basic principle of statism, the principle that man's life belongs to the state. A mixed economy is merely a semi-socialized economy, which means a semi-enslaved society, which means a country torn by irreconcilable contradictions in the process of gradual disintegration. Freedom in a political context means freedom from government coercion. It does not mean freedom from the landlord, or freedom from the employer, or freedom from the laws of nature which do not provide men with automatic prosperity. It means freedom from the coercive power of the state, and nothing else. The world conflict of today is the conflict of the individual against the state, the same conflict that has been fought throughout mankind's history. The names change, but the essence and the results remain the same, whether it is the individual against feudalism, or against absolute monarchy, or against communism, or fascism, or Nazism, or socialism, or the welfare state. If one upholds freedom, one must uphold man's individual rights. If one upholds man's individual rights, one must uphold his right to his own life, to his own liberty, to the pursuit of his own happiness, which means one must uphold a political system that guarantees and protects these rights, which means the politico-economic system of capitalism. Individual rights, freedom, justice, progress were the philosophical values, the theoretical goals, and the practical results of capitalism. No other system can create them or maintain them. No other system ever has or will. For proof, consider the nature and function of basic principles. For evidence, consult history and the present state of the different countries of Europe. The issue is not slavery for a good cause versus slavery for a bad cause. The issue is not dictatorship by a good gang versus dictatorship by a bad gang. The issue is freedom versus dictatorship. It is only after men have chosen slavery and dictatorship that they can begin the usual gang warfare of socialized countries. Today it is called pressure group warfare, over whose gang will rule, who will enslave whom, whose property will be plundered for whose benefit, who will be sacrificed to whose noble purpose. All such arguments come later and are in fact of no consequence. The results will always be the same. The first choice, and the only one that matters, is freedom or dictatorship, capitalism or statism. That is the choice which today's political leaders are determined to evade. The liberals are trying to put statism over by stealth, statism of a semi-socialist, semi-fascist kind, without letting the country realize what road they are taking to what ultimate goal. And while such a policy is reprehensible, there is something more reprehensible still, the policy of the conservatives who are trying to defend freedom by stealth. If the liberals are afraid to identify their program by its proper name, if they advocate every specific step, measure, policy, and principle of statism, but squirm and twist themselves into semantic pretzels with such euphemisms as the welfare state, the New Deal, the New Frontier, they still preserve a semblance of logic, if not of morality. It is the logic of a con man who cannot afford to let his victims discover his purpose. Besides, the majority of those who are loosely identified by the term liberals are afraid to let themselves discover that what they advocate is statism. They do not want to accept the full meaning of their goal. They want to keep all the advantages and effects of capitalism while destroying the cause, and they want to establish statism without its necessary effects. They do not want to know or to admit that they are the champions of dictatorship and slavery. So they evade the issue for fear of discovering that their goal is evil. Immoral as this might be, what is one to think of men who evade the issue for fear of discovering that their goal is good? What is the moral stature of those who are afraid to proclaim that they are the champions of freedom? What is the integrity of those who outdo their enemies in smearing, misrepresenting, spitting at, and apologizing for their own ideal? What is the rationality of those who expect to trick people into freedom, cheat them into justice, fool them into progress, con them into preserving their rights, and while indoctrinating them with statism, put one over on them and let them wake up in a perfect capitalist society some morning? These are the conservatives, or most of their intellectual spokesmen. One need not wonder why they are losing elections, or why this country is stumbling anxiously, reluctantly toward statism. One need not wonder why any cause represented or upheld in such a manner is doomed. One need not wonder why any group with such a policy does in fact declare its own bankruptcy, forfeiting any claim to moral, intellectual, or political leadership. The meaning of the Liberals' program is pretty clear by now. But what are the Conservatives? What is it that they are seeking to conserve? It is generally understood that those who support the Conservatives expect them to uphold the system which has been camouflaged by the loose term of the American way of life. The moral treason of the conservative leaders lies in the fact that they are hiding behind that camouflage. They do not have the courage to admit that the American way of life was capitalism, that that was the politico-economic system born and established in the United States, the system which, in one brief century, achieved a level of freedom, of progress, of prosperity, of human happiness unmatched in all the other systems and centuries combined, and that that is the system which they are now allowing to perish by silent default. If the conservatives do not stand for capitalism, they stand for and are nothing. They have no goal, no direction, no political principles, no social ideals, no intellectual values, no leadership to offer anyone. Yet capitalism is what the conservatives dare not advocate or defend. They are paralyzed by the profound conflict between capitalism and the moral code which dominates our culture, the morality of altruism. Altruism holds that man has no right to exist for his own sake, that service to others is the only justification of his existence, and that self-sacrifice is his highest moral duty, virtue, and value. Capitalism and altruism are incompatible. They are philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist in the same man or in the same society. The conflict between capitalism and altruism has been undercutting America from her start, and today has reached its climax. The American political system was based on a different moral principle, on the principle of man's inalienable right to his own life, which means on the principle that man has the right to exist for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others, nor sacrificing others to himself, and that men must deal with one another as traitors by voluntary choice to mutual benefit. But this moral principle was merely implied in the American political system. It was not stated explicitly. It was not identified. It was not formulated into a full philosophical code of ethics. This was the unfulfilled task which remained as a deadly flaw in our culture, and which is destroying America today. Capitalism is perishing for lack of a moral base and of a full philosophical defense. The social system based on and consonant with the altruist morality, with the code of self-sacrifice, is socialism in all or any of its variants, fascism, Nazism, communism. All of them treat man as a sacrificial animal to be immolated for the benefit of the group, the tribe, the society, the state. Soviet Russia is the ultimate result, the final product, the full consistent embodiment of the altruist morality in practice. It represents the only way that that morality can ever be practiced. Not daring to challenge the morality of altruism, the conservatives have been struggling to evade the issue of morality or to bypass it. This has cost them their confidence, their courage, and their cause. Observe the guilty evasiveness, the apologetic timidity, the peculiarly non-intellectual, non-philosophical attitude projected by most conservatives in their speeches and in their writings. No man and no movement can succeed without moral certainty, without a full rational conviction of the moral rightness of one's cause. Just as the conservatives feel guilty, uncertain, morally disarmed in fighting the liberals, so the liberals feel guilty, uncertain, morally disarmed in fighting the communists. When men share the same basic premise, it is the most consistent ones who win. So long as men accept the altruist morality, they will not be able to stop the advance of communism. The altruist morality is Soviet Russia's best and only weapon. The hypocrisy of America's position in international affairs, the evasiveness, the self-effacing timidity, the apologies for her wealth, her power, her success, for all the greatest virtues of her system, the avoidance of any mention of capitalism as if it were the skeleton in her closet, have done more for the prestige of Soviet Russia and for the growing spread of communism through the world than the Russians' own cheap bombastic propaganda could ever accomplish. An attitude of moral guilt is not becoming to the leader of a world crusade and will not rouse men to follow us. And what do we ask men to fight for? They would join a crusade for freedom versus slavery, which means for capitalism versus communism, but who will care to fight in a crusade for socialism versus communism? Who will want to fight and die to defend a system under which he will have to do voluntarily, or rather by public vote, what a dictator would accomplish faster and much more thoroughly? The sacrifice of everyone to everyone. Who will want to crusade against murder for the privilege of committing suicide? In recent years, the conservatives have gradually come to a dim realization of the weakness in their position, of the philosophical flaw that had to be corrected. But the means by which they are attempting to correct it are worse than the original weakness. The means are discrediting and destroying the last remnants of their claim to intellectual leadership. There are three interrelated arguments used by today's conservatives to justify capitalism, which can best be designated as the argument from faith, the argument from tradition, the argument from depravity. Sensing their need for a moral base, many conservatives decided to choose religion as their moral justification. They claim that America and capitalism are based on faith in God. Politically, such a claim contradicts the fundamental principles of the United States. In America, religion is a private matter which cannot and must not be brought into political issues. Intellectually, to rest one's case on faith means to concede that reason is on the side of one's enemies, that one has no rational arguments to offer. The conservatives claim that their case rests on faith means that there are no rational arguments to support the American system, no rational justification for freedom, justice, property, individual rights, that these rest on a mystic revelation and can be accepted only on faith, that in reason and logic the enemy is right, but men must hold faith as superior to reason. Consider the implications of that theory. While the communists claim that they are the representatives of reason and science, the conservatives concede it and retreat into the realm of mysticism, of faith, of the supernatural, into another world, surrendering this world to communism. It is the kind of victory that the communists' irrational ideology could never have won on its own merits. Observe the results. On the occasion of Khrushchev's first visit to America, he declared at a televised luncheon that he had threatened to bury us because it has been scientifically proved that communism is the system of the future, destined to rule the world. What did our spokesman answer? Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge answered that our system is based on faith in God. Prior to Khrushchev's arrival, the conservative leaders, including senators and House members, were issuing indignant protests against his visit. But the only action they suggested to the American people, the only practical form of protest, was prayer and the holding of religious services for Khrushchev's victims. To hear prayer offered as their only weapon by the representatives of the most powerful country on earth, a country allegedly dedicated to the fight for freedom, was enough to discredit America and capitalism in anyone's eyes, at home and abroad. Now consider the second argument, the attempt to justify capitalism on the ground of tradition. Certain groups are trying to switch the word conservative into the exact opposite of its modern American usage, to switch it back to its 19th century meaning and to put this over on the public. These groups declare that to be a conservative means to uphold the status quo, the given, the established, regardless of what it might be, regardless of whether it is good or bad, right or wrong, defensible or indefensible. They declare that we must defend the American political system not because it is right, but because our ancestors chose it. Not because it is good, but because it is old. America was created by men who broke with all political traditions and who originated a system unprecedented in history. relying on nothing but the unaided power of their own intellect. But the neoconservatives are now trying to tell us that America was the product of faith in revealed truths and of uncritical respect for the traditions of the past. It is certainly irrational to use the new as a standard of value, to believe that an idea or a policy is good merely because it is new, but it is much more preposterously irrational to use the old as a standard of value, to claim that an idea or a policy is good merely because it's ancient. The liberals are constantly asserting that they represent the future, that they are new, progressive, forward-looking, etc., and they denounce the conservatives as old-fashioned representatives of a dead past. The conservatives concede it, and thus help the liberals to propagate one of today's most grotesque inversions. Collectivism, the ancient frozen status society, is offered to us in the name of progress, while capitalism, the only free, dynamic, creative society ever devised, is defended in the name of stagnation. The plea to preserve tradition as such can appeal only to those who have given up or to those who never intended to achieve anything in life. It is a plea that appeals to the worst elements in men and rejects the best. It appeals to fear, sloth, cowardice, conformity, self-doubt, and rejects creativeness, originality, courage, independence, self-reliance. It is an outrageous plea to address to human beings anywhere, but particularly outrageous here in America, the country based on the principle that man must stand on his own feet, live by his own judgment, and move constantly forward as a productive, creative innovator. The argument that we must respect tradition as such, respect it merely because it is a tradition, means that we must accept the values other men have chosen merely because other men have chosen them, with the necessary implication of, who are we to change them? The affront to a man's self-esteem in such an argument and the profound contempt for man's nature are obvious. This leads us to the third and the worst argument used by some conservatives, the attempt to defend capitalism on the ground of man's depravity. This argument runs as follows. Since men are weak, fallible, non-omniscient, and innately depraved, no man may be entrusted with the responsibility of being a dictator and of ruling everybody else. Therefore, a free society is the proper way of life for imperfect creatures. Please grasp fully the implications of this argument. Since men are depraved, they are not good enough for a dictatorship. Freedom is all that they deserve. If they were perfect, they would be worthy of a totalitarian state. Dictatorship, this theory asserts, believe it or not, is the result of faith in man and in man's goodness. If people believed that man is depraved by nature, they would not entrust a dictator with power. This means that a belief in human depravity protects human freedom, that it is wrong to enslave the depraved, but would be right to enslave the virtuous. And more, dictatorships, this theory declares, and all the other disasters of the modern world, are man's punishment for the sin of relying on his intellect and of attempting to improve his life on earth by seeking to devise a perfect political system and to establish a rational society. This means that humility, passivity, lethargic resignation, and a belief in original sin are the bulwarks of capitalism. One could not go farther than this in historical, political, and psychological ignorance or subversion. This is truly the voice of the Dark Ages rising again in the midst of our industrial civilization. The cynical, man-hating advocates of this theory sneer at all ideals, scoff at all human aspirations, and deride all attempts to improve men's existence. You can't change human nature, is their stock answer to the socialists. Thus they concede that socialism is the ideal, but human nature is unworthy of it. After which they invite men to crusade for capitalism. A crusade one would have to start by spitting in one's own face. Who will fight and die to defend his status as a miserable sinner? If, as a result of such theories, people become contemptuous of conservatism, do not wonder and do not ascribe it to the cleverness of the socialists. Such are capitalism's alleged defenders, and such are the arguments by which they propose to save it. It is obvious that with this sort of theoretical equipment, and with an unbroken record of defeats, concessions, compromises, and betrayals in practice, today's conservatives are futile, impotent, and culturally dead. They have nothing to offer and can achieve nothing. They can only help to destroy intellectual standards, to disintegrate thought, to discredit capitalism, and to accelerate this country's uncontested collapse into despair and dictatorship. But to those of you who do wish to contest it, particularly those of you who are young and are not ready to surrender, I want to give a warning. Nothing is as dead as the stillborn. Nothing is as futile as a movement without goals, or a crusade without ideals, or a battle without ammunition. A bad argument is worse than ineffectual. It lends credence to the arguments of your opponents. A half battle is worse than none. It does not end in mere defeat. It helps and hastens the victory of your enemies. At a time when the world is torn by a profound ideological conflict, do not join those who have no ideology, no ideas, no philosophy to offer you. Do not go into battle armed with nothing but stale slogans, pious platitudes, and meaningless generalities. Do not join any so-called conservative group, organization, or person that advocates any variant of the arguments from faith, from tradition, or from depravity. Any homegrown sophist in any village debate can refute those arguments and can drive you into evasions in about 5 minutes. What would happen to you with such ammunition on the philosophical battlefield of the world? But you would never reach that battlefield. You would not be heard on it, since you would have nothing to say. It is not by means of evasions that one saves civilization. It is not by means of empty slogans that one saves a world perishing for lack of intellectual leadership. It is not by means of ignoring its causes that one cures a deadly disease. So long as the conservatives ignore the issue of what destroyed capitalism and merely plead with men to go back, they cannot escape the question of back to what? And none of their evasions can camouflage the fact that the implicit answer is back to an earlier age of the cancer which is devouring us today and which has almost reached its terminal stage. That cancer is the morality of altruism. So long as the conservatives evade the issue of altruism, all of their pleas and arguments amount in essence to this. Why can't we just go back to the 19th century, when capitalism and altruism seemed somehow to coexist? Why do we have to go to extremes and think of surgery when the early stages of the cancer were painless? The answer is that the facts of reality, which includes history and philosophy, are not to be evaded. Capitalism was destroyed by the morality of altruism. Capitalism is based on individual rights, not on the sacrifice of the individual to the public good of the collective. Capitalism and altruism are incompatible. It's one or the other. It's too late for compromises, for platitudes, and for aspirin tablets. There is no way to save capitalism, or freedom, or civilization, or America, except by intellectual surgery. That is, by destroying the source of the destruction, by rejecting the morality of altruism. If you want to fight for capitalism, there is only one type of argument that you should adopt, the only one that can ever win in a moral issue, the argument from self-esteem. This means the argument from man's right to exist, from man's inalienable individual right to his own life. I quote from my book For the New Intellectual. The world crisis of today is a moral crisis, and nothing less than a moral revolution can resolve it. A moral revolution to sanction and complete the political achievement of the American Revolution. The new intellectual must fight for capitalism, not as a practical issue, not as an economic issue, but with the most righteous pride as a moral issue. That is what capitalism deserves, and nothing less will save it. Capitalism is not the system of the past, it is the system of the future. If mankind is to have a future, those who wish to fight for it must discard the title of conservatives. Conservatism has always been a misleading name, inappropriate to America. Today there is nothing left to conserve. The established political philosophy, the intellectual orthodoxy, and the status quo are collectivism. Those who reject all the basic premises of collectivism are radicals in the proper sense of the word. Radical means fundamental. Today, the fighters for capitalism have to be not bankrupt conservatives, but new radicals, new intellectuals, and above all, new dedicated moralists. Chapter 20. The New Fascism, Rule by Consensus, by Ayn Rand. I shall begin by doing a very unpopular thing that does not fit today's intellectual fashions, and is therefore anti-consensus. I shall begin by defining my terms so that you will know what I am talking about. Let me give you the dictionary definitions of three political terms: socialism, fascism, and statism. Socialism, a theory or system of social organization which advocates the vesting of the ownership and control of the means of production, capital, land, etc., in the community as a whole. Fascism, a governmental system with strong centralized power, permitting no opposition or criticism, controlling all affairs of the nation, industrial, commercial, etc. Statism, the principle or policy of concentrating extensive economic, political, and related controls in the state at the cost of individual liberty. It is obvious that statism is the wider generic term, of which the other two are specific variants. It is also obvious that statism is the dominant political trend of our day. But which of those two variants represents the specific direction of that trend? Observe that both socialism and fascism involve the issue of property rights. The right to property is the right of use and disposal. Observe the difference in those two theories. Socialism negates private property rights altogether and advocates the vesting of ownership and control in the community as a whole, i.e. in the state. Fascism leaves ownership in the hands of private individuals, but transfers control of the property to the government. Ownership without control is a contradiction in terms. It means property without the right to use it or to dispose of it. It means that the citizens retain the responsibility of holding property without any of its advantages, while the government acquires all the advantages without any of the responsibility. In this respect, socialism is the more honest of the two theories. I say more honest, not better, because in practice there is no difference between them. Both come from the same collectivist statist principle. Both negate individual rights and subordinate the individual to the collective. Both deliver the livelihood and the lives of the citizens into the power of an omnipotent government. And the differences between them are only a matter of time, degree, and superficial detail, such as the choice of slogans by which the rulers delude their enslaved subjects. Which of these two variants of statism are we moving towards, socialism or fascism? To answer this question, one must first ask, which is the dominant ideological trend of today's culture? The disgraceful and terrifying answer is, there is no ideological trend today. There is no ideology. There are no political principles, theories, ideals, or philosophy. There is no direction, no goal, no compass, no vision of the future, no intellectual element of leadership. Are there any emotional elements dominating today's culture? Yes, one, fear. A country without a political philosophy is like a ship drifting at random in mid-ocean, at the mercy of any chance wind, wave, or current. A ship whose passengers huddle in their cabins and cry, "Don't rock the boat," for fear of discovering that the captain's bridge is empty. It is obvious that a boat which cannot stand rocking is doomed already, and that it had better be rocked hard if it is to regain its course. But this realization presupposes a grasp of facts, of reality, of principles, and a long-range view, all of which are precisely the things that the non-rockers are frantically struggling to evade. Just as a neurotic believes that the facts of reality will vanish if he refuses to recognize them, so today the neurosis of an entire culture leads men to believe that their desperate need of political principles and concepts will vanish if they succeed in obliterating all principles and concepts. But since, in fact, neither an individual nor a nation can exist without some form of ideology, this sort of anti-ideology is now the formal, explicit, dominant ideology of our bankrupt culture. This anti-ideology has a new and very ugly name. It is called government by consensus. If some demagogue were to offer us as a guiding creed the following tenets: that statistics should be substituted for truth, vote counting for principles, numbers for rights, and public polls for morality, that pragmatic, range-of-the-moment expediency should be the criterion of a country's interests, and that the number of its adherents should be the criterion of an idea's truth or falsehood, that any desire of any nature whatsoever should be accepted as a valid claim, provided it is held by a sufficient number of people, that a majority may do anything it pleases to a minority, in short, gang rule and mob rule, if a demagogue were to offer it, he would not get very far. Yet all of it is contained in and camouflaged by the notion of government by consensus. This notion is now being plugged not as an ideology, but as an anti-ideology, not as a principle, but as a means of obliterating principles, not as reason, but as rationalization, as a verbal ritual or a magic formula to assuage the national anxiety neurosis, a kind of pep pill or goofball for the non-boat rockers, and a chance to play it deuces wild for the others. It is only today's lethargic contempt for the pronouncements of our political and intellectual leaders that blinds people to the meaning, implications, and consequences of a notion of government by consensus. You have all heard it, and I suspect dismissed it as politicians' oratory, giving no thought to its actual meaning. But that is what I urge you to consider. This book is continued on Disc 8.